Well, we're in 1 Kings chapter 19 this morning in our Bibles. Last week we started a series on dealing with disappointment. And in that, in our introduction last week, we made a few points. First of all, disappointment is a reality of life. And disappointment is a result of unfulfilled expectations. There are different levels of disappointment, and no one is immune to disappointment. The truth of the matter is that sometimes in life we can feel like we're Charlie Brown. That every time we go to kick the football, somebody pulls it out from underneath us. Or it can feel like every time we try to fly a kite, we can't get in the air, and if it gets in the air for 2 seconds, it gets stuck in the tree. Or we're walking around and it's sunny everywhere else, but we got a storm cloud right above us. And you say, do people really feel that way? I think so. I think there are times in life where we have real sorrow and real disappointment, and life doesn't go exactly the way we wanted it to, the way we expected it to, the way we hoped it would. But the truth of the matter is, even in the midst of the disappointing circumstances, God is still on the throne and God is still in control. Now, last week we looked at Moses and the children of Israel as they wandered through the wilderness. And this week we're looking at 1 Kings chapter 19. We'll begin reading in verse number 1. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and withal how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, so let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life, and came to Beersheba, which belongeth to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, and came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die. He said, it is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am not better than my father's. And as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him and said unto him, arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baking on the coals and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink and laid him down again. And the angel of the Lord came again the second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee. As we think of disappointment, we realize that there are real disappointments in this life. I joked about going to kick the football and somebody pulled the football out, or not being able to get the kite in the air, or getting stuck in the tree. Those are pretty minimal problems in life, aren't they? The truth of the matter is, sometimes you go to pay your bills, but there's not enough money in the account to write the rest of the bills. Sometimes you already have an incredible amount of medical debt only to find out that you need another procedure. Sometimes someone that you care about and invested in has wandered away from the Lord. Sometimes you go to the doctor hoping for a good report only to be met with the opposite. The truth of the matter is, there are real disappointments in life, and we see somebody here in this story who got very disappointed. In fact, we'll get to this later, but his disappointment went further than disappointment. It turned into discouragement. He allowed himself to get under the circumstances. And as we look at this passage this morning, I want us to recognize three things. And the first thing I'd like for us to recognize are the circumstances that led to the disappointment in Elijah's life. First, we see that the disappointment came after a long struggle. Most good things don't come quickly or easily. Any long-term efforts, working to strengthen a marriage, building a Sunday school or a bus route or ministry, raising children or restoring a broken relationship, all of those things take time. But during the process, our patience can wear thin, and if we don't see immediate results, we can end up feeling like our effort was a waste. Have you ever started a diet
only to quit within the first week? It wasn't worth the effort. I mean, I only ate two bowls of ice cream tonight, not three, and I got on the scale tomorrow and didn't lose any weight. It's not worth trying. You ever started an exercise program only to quit? You started lifting weights, and after 2 weeks, the weights only seemed to be getting heavier, and the arms didn't seem to be getting any bigger. So you said, "Phooey, I'm not doing that anymore." Tried that one. I remember somebody at the church that we used to attend. A new family came in, and we got up and announced church-wide visitation, and they said, "What is church-wide visitation?" I said, "Well, we go out and we knock on people's doors and we try to talk to them about where they're going to spend eternity, try to talk to them about whether or not they have a relationship with Jesus Christ. And we try to win people to Christ and invite people to church." And they said, "Oh, yeah, our church, we did that for a while. We tried that for a couple of months. It didn't work. We just didn't do it." You see, they tried it for a couple of months, and because the church didn't triple, they thought, "Let's forget that. That doesn't work anymore." We can be that way sometimes in our microwave society, can't we? You remember dial-up internet? These guys don't, but you got on there, and you got on AOL or whatever you were on, and what you heard was... And it did that for who knows how long. And then it finally took you to the internet. And when you would click on a website, you would wait and wait and wait. You know what one of my least favorite sites in the world is? That little spinny circle thing. That little spinny circle thing that says loading, you need to be patient. I got on a site recently and it said, "This will only take a second." And then underneath that it says, "We know it's taking longer than a second, but be patient." We don't like to be patient, do we? I don't like it when the light turns green and the person in front of me doesn't go immediately. In fact, I want them to be anticipating the green lights so that they are ready to go. I don't like when I get in a drive-thru at a fast food restaurant and don't move for 20 minutes. I want things my way right away. I want things to go quickly. And in life, when we don't get the solution as fast as we would like, sometimes we can start to get discouraged. You know, we read a portion of the story of Elijah. But honestly, this battle between Elijah and Ahab and Jezebel has been going on for years. In fact, if we were to go back to chapter 17, what we would find out was Elijah brought a message to Ahab that it wasn't going to rain for over 3 years. And after that, God told him he needed to hide out down by the brook Cherith. And down there, God would provide food for him and water for him until the brook dried up. And when the brook dried up, God said, "Go over to this widow lady and with her son, and they're going to provide for you over there." And when he gets there, all excited that now he's got a home to sleep in, and now he's got some real food that doesn't have to be brought to him by ravens. And he's probably excited about that, only to get there and find out that there's actually no food left. Just enough for her to make some small cakes for her and her son, and then that was going to be their last meal. And they were going to starve to death because of the drought. Of course, God provided miraculously and the meal never ran out. And then, as things seemed to be going well, the widow's son dies. It's like he can't catch a break. He's done what God has called him to do. He's gone and talked to Ahab, and he's being used of the Lord to give the message of God to the king of Israel. He's doing what he's supposed to do, and yet though he's doing what he's supposed to do, all he meets is difficulty after difficulty after difficulty. God miraculously raises that boy from the dead. And then God says to him, "I want you to go back to Ahab, and I want you to speak to Ahab again." Now, it's been 3.5 years since he spoke to Ahab last. He's been hiding out. And by the way, why do you hide out? Why was he hiding out? Because his life was on the line, wasn't it? Ahab wanted him dead. Ahab was taking out the prophets of God. Jezebel was taking out those who opposed her false gods. And people were literally being martyred all over the country. And this is a roller coaster ride for Elijah for 3.5 years of his life. Have you ever been on the roller coaster of life and thought to yourself, when is it going to smooth out? Has life ever felt like whitewater rafting to you? As soon as you get past that little calm stretch, boom, there's the rapids again. Oh no, we got to start rolling again. Oh no, we're bobbing all over again. And that's how Elijah's life must have felt. He just went from one thing to the next thing to the next thing. And every situation that he found himself in, God showed himself mighty. God provided, God directed, God protected. God was doing his part all along the line, and Elijah was following God's plan for his life, and yet it was not smooth sailing. It's like we believe this American lie of Christianity, that if you become a Christian, everything in your life is going to be smooth sailing from here on out. Now, if you've been a Christian for more than 5 minutes, you know that's not true. It's not what we see in the Bible, is it? Was it smooth sailing for the disciples? Was it smooth sailing for the Apostle Paul? I'm not trying to discourage you this morning, but what I am trying to tell you is it had been a long time coming by the time Elijah meets with these prophets of Baal and these prophets of the groves up on Mount Carmel. It had been a long, arduous struggle in Elijah's life. We see it came after a long struggle. We see it was after a great victory. What happened up there on Mount Carmel? He told them to put their sacrifice up there on their altar, and he was going to put his sacrifice up on the altar of God after he repaired the altar and had them dig a trench around it and poured water all over the altar and down in the trench 3 different times. And he says, why don't you cry out to your God? And they cried out to their God and cried out to their God and cried out to their God for hours to no avail. They start to cut themselves, they weep, they howl, they pray, nothing happens. And when it's his turn, he cries out to God, and what does God do? He sends down fire from heaven to consume that sacrifice and to lick up all that water. And then afterwards, after this showdown with the prophets of Baal to see who is the one true God, what do all the people say? The people say, the Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. Their eyes had been opened. They said, no, God is the true one. Jehovah is the true one. We need to stop worshiping Baal. And then he slew the prophets of Baal. That's a great victory. He goes over and he has a seat and he puts his head down and he starts to pray and he tells his servant to go out and to look and to see what's off in the distance. And he comes back a couple of times and eventually he says, there's a cloud coming out there. It looks like a man's hand. And he says, it's going to rain. And he said, go tell Ahab, you better get home to Jezreel before he gets stuck in the rain. And after that, Elijah sets out on foot and outruns Ahab, who's in his chariot, to Jezreel. That's 15 miles. And when Ahab pulls in, Elijah's sitting there waiting for him. Now I'll tell you what, if you do a standoff, you versus 850 people, they think they're right, you think you're right. And at the end, it is proven that you are right. And you win the victory over the enemies of God, over 850 people, and all of a sudden the people who had been opposing God start saying, the Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God, and it looks like a revival is breaking out, and God has done some miraculous things. I don't know about you, but I think I'd be on cloud nine. I think I'd be topside. I think I'd be excited about everything that was going on. He just came off a mountaintop experience. You ever had a mountaintop experience before? You ever had a day where you were just rejoicing in the Lord and everything in your life was going great and you were so excited about what God was doing? There was some miracle, there was some answer to prayer, and you were just pumped about what God was doing in your life. You know the problem with mountaintop experiences is you don't usually stay up on the mountain, do you? He had to come down off the mountain, didn't he? And there was still more work to be done for the Lord. And when he got down off that mountain, he realized not everybody was excited about what God was doing. It came right after a great victory. We see it's after a long struggle, after a great victory. It was at a low point physically. At a low point physically. He had gone up there, and I can't imagine how exhausting it was to be up there on Mount Carmel and to have this showdown and all of the emotion of what was going on. And then all of a sudden, after fighting all of these prophets of Baal and prophets of the groves and killing 850 men, after doing that, he runs 15 miles to get to Jezreel. And all of a sudden, he's exhausted. It was Vince Lombardi who said, "Fatigue makes cowards of us all." You know, sometimes we get run down physically. Sometimes it's just a lack of sleep. Sometimes it's a lack of energy. Sometimes it's a lack of health. But whatever it may be, in this instance, Elijah was exhausted and he lost courage. Lastly, as far as the circumstances are concerned, we see it was after a personal attack. After a personal attack. Who made a personal attack on Elijah here in chapter 19? It was Jezebel, wasn't it? Look at verse 2. "Then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, 'So let the gods do to me and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time.'" There's a personal attack on Elijah. Let me ask you this question before. You don't have to raise your hand. But let me ask you this question before we go further. Have you ever had somebody attack you personally? Have you ever had somebody impugn your character? Question your motives? Have you ever had somebody attack a member of your family? Have you ever had somebody attack one of your children? Try to rob their joy? And try to make their life miserable? That happens. It's hard for Mama Bear not to come out, right? Like, we don't like being under personal attack. And when you're trying to do all that you can for the Lord, when you're trying to live in obedience to God, when you're trying to accomplish His will for your life and His work on this planet, when you're trying to do all that God has called you to do, and you're just met with opposition after opposition, and all of a sudden people misunderstand what you said or misunderstood what you did, and you're trying to do what you can for the Lord, but everybody around you seems to be either attacking you or abandoning you, it's pretty easy to get disappointed and discouraged. And that's where Elijah finds himself in this passage. These are the circumstances that led to the disappointment. Now let's look at the slippery slope of disappointment. Disappointment oftentimes, if not dealt with properly and kept in the proper perspective, disappointment turns into discouragement. And the truth of the matter is discouragement can even head to an area called depression. There's an old story of the devil selling off his tools. And as people milled around looking over the goods he sold, they noticed that there were plenty of items that they could purchase. Plenty of fancy looking tools like anger and hatred and vengeance and lust. But then they noticed the item with the highest price tag was the least impressive looking tool there. An old battered wedge. Attached was a sticker with a single word, discouragement. Since the wedge showed signs of wear and heavy use, a curious customer asked the devil why such an unattractive item cost so much. And he replied, "If I can drive the wedge of discouragement between a believer and his Lord, I win the victory every time." Rest assured, the devil desires to destroy you. He wants to rob you of your joy. He wants to rob you of your testimony. He wants to rob you of your peace. He wants to rob you of your usefulness. And what God has called you to, He wants to rob you of the power of God. He wants to rob you of everything good that God has given you. And he can do that through trying to tempt you. He can do that through trying to deceive you. But I'll tell you one of the things that the devil will try to use in your life to get you sidetracked and not doing what you should for the Lord, or not doing it with the power of the Lord, and that is discouragement. If discouragement is not dealt with, it can actually lead to a word that's kind of unpopular to talk about in our circle sometimes. We act as if it doesn't exist, or if somebody has this, that they're misdiagnosed. But the truth of the matter is, I think we can make an argument in this passage that Elijah just went straight past discouragement, straight to depression. When you're laying there under the tree begging God to take your life, I think we can make the argument that he had gotten a little depressed about this. May 17, 2023, according to the Gallup poll, U.S. depression rates are at an all-time high. More than one in six adults have depression as rates rise to record levels, was another title of an article. Depression is prevalent among a substantial portion of the global population, affecting around 280 million people worldwide. In 2023, 29% of Americans report having been diagnosed with depression in their lifetime. In 2023, half of adults ages 18 to 24 reported anxiety and depression symptoms. Depression doesn't just affect adults. A growing number of children are struggling as well. My point this morning is not to make you depressed. My point this morning is to say, when we allow ourselves to focus on the circumstances rather than on our Savior, life can become overwhelming real quick. We see a vicious cycle here. When we focus on our circumstances, a given to discouragement, our faith turns to fear. Now, it's ironic in this passage, he had gone to Ahab's face and spoken very boldly on two occasions, right? He had stood up against all of the enemies of God on Mount Carmel and never backed down a step. There was no lack of boldness there. And now all of a sudden this lady gives an empty threat. And he's done. He's ready to pack in the bag. You say, what do you mean an empty threat? Well, let me help you think about it this way, if I could. If you wanted to kill somebody, are you going to announce it? Especially after it's the first time you saw the guy in 3.5 years. The last time he knew you were angry at him, he disappeared for 3.5 years. Now all of a sudden he resurfaces. Are you going to send a messenger to tell him that you're going to kill him if you actually want to kill him? No. You're just going to go take care of the business, right? You don't send the messenger, you send the assassin. She sent the messenger to let him know because I think she wanted exactly what happened. She wanted to scare him and make him get out of Dodge so she wouldn't have to deal with him. Because she saw that his God was more powerful than her God. And that's exactly what he does. Rather than responding in faith, when he talked to Ahab, is because God told him to. When he went to the brook Cherith, it's because God told him to. When he went to the widow, it was because God told him to. When he went to go see Ahab again, it was because God told him to. When he went to Mount Carmel, it was because God told him to. When he went to Jezreel, it was because God told him to. All along, he's been living by faith. And all of a sudden, in a moment where he's exhausted and he's tired, and he's under personal attack, it became too much for him to bear. And his faith gives way to fear. Not only do we see that when we focus on our circumstances and get into discouragement, our faith turns to fear, we start to worry and not work. He's enlisted in the work of God, but he says, God, I'm so worried about what Jezebel said. I can't do what you've called me to do anymore. Just take me home. I'm done. Not only is our faith turned to fear and we start to worry instead of work, but we live with pity rather than praise. When God finally confronts him and he says, Elijah, what are you doing here? Look at verse 10. He said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts. This is Elijah's answer. In verse 9, God says, what are you doing here, Elijah? In verse 10, he said, I've been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. You see, when Elijah is focusing on himself, we see the same thing in verse number 14. He says, what doest thou here? And towards the end of the verse, he says, I am left. They seek my life to take it away. When he asked God to take his life earlier in the chapter, he said, it is enough now, Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers. The other prophets were killed, and I haven't done a better job than they've done. God, I've failed. I'm not doing anything useful. Just take me home too. Who is his focus on? It's on himself. You want a surefire way to be discouraged? Focus on self and circumstances. And eventually you'll end up discouraged. How do you get over discouragement? Get your eyes off yourself, get your eyes off your circumstances, get your eyes on your Savior. We have to learn to meditate on what is true and good, not on what we feel. Elijah said, I'm the only one left, God. There's nobody else in the world trying to do right anymore. I'm the only one who has a heart for you. Do you realize even at a church this size that sometimes people can feel that way? Oh man, we're the only ones who haven't removed the ancient landmarks. I'm telling you, everybody else is compromising. We're the only ones staying true to God. We're the only ones serving all the time. We're the only ones giving our all. We're the only... Do you realize that people can say stuff like that? Do you realize that 99.999999% of the time when people are saying that about themselves in a situation, they are completely and utterly wrong? You are not the only believer left in this world, and you're not the only one trying to live for God, and you're not the only one struggling right now, and you're not the only one that God has a purpose or a plan for. You're not the only one trying to get the job done. There are a lot of others doing all they can for the Lord as well. God, I'm the only one. Nobody else is going through what I'm going through. It's ironic because when he was looking for Ahab, he ran into a guy named Obadiah. And you know what Obadiah told him? Obadiah said, Jezebel started killing all the prophets. You know what I did? I hid 100 of them in a cave. You know what that means? He knew already there were at least 100 other people who had not bowed to Baal. He knew up on the mountain there were a whole host of people who said, the Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. He knew that. And yet in his moment of self-pity, while he's throwing himself a pity party, was he saying, I'm the only one, God? And what does God have to say to him? No, there's more than 7,000 knees, people who haven't bowed to Baal. Buster, you ain't the only one. I'm still working here. Philippians 4:8 says this, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. It's a filter for our mind. Let me ask you this question. When you have negative feelings, are the feelings always based on truth? They're not always based on truth. That's why God says, think on things that are true. Our hearts are deceitful and desperately wicked, right? Our feelings aren't always even because of truth. So God says, think on truth. What does he do? He flees from Jezebel. He ran more than 100 miles away. He had just run 15 miles to get to Jezreel. Now he runs 100 miles away into the wilderness. He pushed everyone else in his life away. His servant wanted to go with him. He said, no, you stay here. And he went another day's journey into the wilderness. Hebrews 10, 24 and 25 says this, and let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another and so much the more as ye see the day approaching. It is our tendency when we're going through difficulty to push others in our life away. And God says, don't do that. This passage that was written to these Hebrew children, these saints, We have to remember when this book was written. They were under great persecution. And it would have been easier for the believers to avoid meeting together in the name of safety. But the author of Hebrews, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, knew that God's people need each other most when times are tough. Sometimes when times are difficult, we want to push everybody else in our life away. And that's the time we need to let other people in. He wanted to give up. He said, God, take me home. I failed. I haven't done any better than my fathers. Just get me out of here. I'm done. I can't do it anymore. I've done everything you want me to do. And Ahab and Jezebel have no intention of turning back to you. They have no intention of getting right with you. They have no intention of allowing a revival to take place in this nation. God, I've done everything I could, and yet I have failed. I'm ready to give up. And here is the sad thing. He was so discouraged in the Lord's work that he was ready to give over Israel to the devil. If he really believed he was the only one still doing the work, it would be all that more important for him to stick around, wouldn't it? He said, it's too hard. I don't want any part of this. I've done everything I could. It hasn't gotten any easier. I just got done hiding for 3.5 years and now I'm running for my life again. God, we saw a revival up on the mountain, but it's not going to matter because Jezebel's still on the throne and Ahab's still on the throne, and they're going to squelch anything you try to do in the country, and they have no intention of getting their hearts right with you. God, I've done everything I could, but I'm not seeing any traction here in the ministry. I've prayed and I've ministered and I've done all that I could, but it's not making a difference. You ever felt that way before in your ministry? You ever felt that way before in your family? God, I've prayed and I've prayed for my children and I've done everything I could and we've made changes. And God, we're trying to do what's right. We're trying to bring them up in nurture and admonition of the Lord, and we're not seeing any difference. God, I've poured my heart into that Sunday school class and I've invested in those little kids and I've tried to reach out to the parents and I'm not seeing anything get better. God, I've done all I could for this bus route and it seems like we have less and less every week. God, why are we not seeing the growth? Why are we not seeing people get right with you? God, why is that not happening? That's where Elijah was. He said, I'm done with this. I'm ready to quit. I'm sick of it. Not doing it anymore. It doesn't work. I've tried to obey. It's not making a difference. God, I'm ready to throw in the towel. Just take me home. Now, if we stopped right here, this would be a depressing message. It really would. But I'm glad the story doesn't stop right here. We've seen the circumstances that led to his disappointment and his discouragement. We've seen the slippery slope of disappointment, that if we focus on disappointing things in life rather than God's goodness, it can lead to discouragement and even to depression. Lastly, let's look at the solution, because that's where the value is. What is the solution for dealing with disappointments? First of all, the first thing we see here in this passage, let's begin reading in verse number 3. This is when he stops living by faith, he starts living by sight, and when he saw that, when he saw she wanted to kill him, he arose and went for his life and came to Beersheba, which belonged to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die and said, it is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my fathers. And as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him and said unto him, arise and eat. Now I want you to think about this. If you ran over 115 miles in just a few days, there would have to be some major motivation there. In other words, he really thought he was running for his life. 115 miles in just a few days, he really thought she was on his tail, on his track, she was going to get him, she was going to have him taken out. He said, I got to get out of here. He's running and running and running. He has lost his courage. He has lost his faith. And even though he thinks the enemy's right behind him and he's about to die, what does he do? He took a nap. Now, what does that tell you? This man is spent. He is exhausted. He has got nothing left. I mean, he is doing everything he can to get away from the enemy. He is running for his life. He is trying to preserve himself. He has lost all his courage. And even though he's willing to run 100 miles away from the direction of Jezebel and Ahab, in the middle of that, he's like, I cannot go one step further. He collapses. How do we know he's exhausted? Look at it. He falls asleep in verse 5. The angel comes and touches him, said unto him, arise and eat. Verse 6, he looked and behold, there was a cake baking on the coals and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink. And what did he do after he ate and drank the food? He went back to sleep. Like he's tired. Do you know sometimes what we need is not to quit the battle forever, but what we do need is rest sometimes? In other words, sometimes we have to come apart, get over here for some rest, because before we fall apart. Who instituted the Sabbath day? God did, right? First 6 days, he created. What did he do on the seventh? You rested. Now let me ask you this question. Do you really think God needed rest after 6 days of creation? No. So why did he rest on the seventh day? To be an example to finite people. An infinite God did something to be an example to finite people. He says, listen, you've got to take a break every once in a while. You've got to rest every once in a while. You've got to take a breath every once in a while, or you're going to fall apart. We see that right here in this passage. And sometimes we just need to take a rest. In addition to that, we need time alone with God. Verse 8, and he arose and did eat and drink and went in the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the Mount of God. Now he travels maybe another 200 miles to Mount Horeb. He gets there after walking for 40 days and 40 nights. And who does he spend all of his time with once he gets there? He spends all his time with God. In the midst of his discouragement, in the midst of his self-pity, in the midst of his depression, God comes and ministers to him there, and God speaks to him in a still, small voice. As I was reading this, I thought Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Is that not what happened in this passage? Elijah laid down and rested. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. Do you know what God was trying to do in this passage for Elijah? He was trying to restore him. Elijah, I'm not done with you yet. Elijah, I got more for you to do. Elijah, I'm able to help you through this. I love what it says at the end of verse number 7. What's the last phrase of verse number 7? Because the journey is too great for thee. Like the angel flat told him, Elijah, what you're being asked to do, it's too much for your strength, buddy. Do you realize, whether or not you realize it on a daily basis, what God desires to use you for is too much for you? It's too much for you to carry. It's too much for you to do. It's too much responsibility. You can't do it in your own strength. Have we heard it said before? The Christian life is not a difficult life. The Christian life is an impossible life. Apart from God's help, we can do nothing. Elijah, the journey is too great for you. But after he got alone and he spent some time with God, what happened? His focus was changed, wasn't it? Forgot about Jezebel for a while. He forgot about Ahab for a while. He forgot about the prophet against the battle against the prophets of Baal. He forgot about the price that's been put on his head. He forgot about all of that when he got into the presence of an Almighty God. And as he started spending time with God, his perspective on everything in his life started to change. The last thing is, we see this. He said, what does God do with them? What does God tell them is the solution? God tells him, hey, go take a vacation, Elijah. You're just a little burned out, buddy. Get on a cruise for a couple of weeks. When you come back, you'll be fabulous. Is that what happens? No, God enlists him and says, get back to work. He says, down here, in verse number 15, the Lord said to him, go, return to thy way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when thou comest, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria, and Jehu the son of Nimshi shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room. And it shall come to pass that him that escapeth the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapeth from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. He says, listen, I want you to go anoint Jehu, and I want you to go anoint Hazael, and I want you to go anoint Elisha. And from the point where Elisha said, God, will you just take me home? God, would you just kill me? God, I'm done here. I have failed. I am an utter failure. I can't be used anymore, God. I'm not accomplishing anything for you. There's some ironies there. Number one, the irony is Elijah, who asked God to take his life, was one of two men in the Bible who never died. You know, there's a good lesson there. Sometimes when God says no to your prayers, it's a good thing. The other lesson is this. Do you know when Elijah finally does get taken up in that chariot of fire? You know when he does get taken up? It's 10 years from this date. God still had 10 years worth of work for Elijah to do. And God used him in amazing and miraculous ways. I wonder how the rest of the kings would play out if he never went and anointed Elisha. If he never invested in Elisha. If he gave up that day in the wilderness and said, no, God, I'm done. I'm not going to go mentor the next guy. I'm not going to go anoint the next guy. God, I am done with your work. I quit. I'm finished. You can't use me anymore. I wonder how the rest of the book would have turned out. Because you know, Elisha went out and he did twice as many miracles as Elijah did. This young man that he invested in, this young man that he mentored, this young man that he gave his life to, this young man, he made a difference in the days ahead. Do you realize there's a generation right now that needs you to invest in them as well? God is not done with us. We are going to celebrate our 90th anniversary in May. Not my wife and I, the church, Cranberry Baptist Church. All right? She's only 31, so we cannot celebrate our 90th anniversary. We're going to celebrate 90 years. Do you realize God is not done with Cranberry Baptist Church? You say, well, I'm 80 years old, and I've been saved since I was 6, and God has used me all my life. Do you realize as long as you're on this side of the grave, God is not done using you? And if we are not careful, there are a million, there are a billion things in this world that can disappoint us. In fact, I know that there's at least 8 billion things in this world can disappoint us, because there's 8 billion people in this world. And you hang around people long enough, they're going to disappoint you. There are billions of reasons to be disappointed, and there are reasons to get discouraged, and there are reasons to give up. And here's what God is saying. God is saying, listen, I am not done with you. Yes, the journey is too great for you, but it is not too great for me. Get your eyes off yourself. Get your eyes off your circumstances. Get your eyes on your Savior. Stop giving into your feelings. Start living by faith and realize I still have more work for you to do. I'm still working. I'm still able to do exceeding abundantly above all that you have to think. I'm still in charge. I'm still on the throne. You can trust me. Don't quit. Don't ever quit. Because I still got more for you to do. And I'm going to help you do it. May the Lord help us. Anybody in here besides me ever been disappointed in life? Anybody in here besides me ever been distracted by disappointments to the point that you've gotten discouraged before? Yeah. You realize God doesn't want you to live discouraged? Oh, there will be disappointments. But He doesn't want you to live discouraged. He wants you to live by faith. He says, I'm not done with you. I never stopped caring about you. I'm still the one looking over you. I still have a plan for you. I'm still going to use you. Get back up and keep